It has now been over a year since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, an event that shook the world but was far from inevitable. What seemed inevitable, at least at first, was the collapse of the Ukrainian state and its institutions predicted by some analysts and even intelligence circles. Instead, we continue to witness the unprecedented unity of Ukrainians behind their nation's struggle. In this episode, we look at why initial fears did not materialize and ask how such unity can be sustained to consolidate Ukraine's agency in the new era of global competition.
The President of Ukraine.
Great honor for me to be at the U.S. Congress and speak to you and all Americans. Against all odds and doom and gloom scenarios, Ukraine didn't fall. Ukraine is alive and kicking.
Welcome to the Conflict Zone podcast from the London School of Economics with me, Malek Banat. Together, we explore the changing nature of global conflict in the 21st century by taking a closer look at the causes and drivers of war and intractable violence. Our team of experts draw on cutting-edge research and big ideas to expose the networks of money and power producing violent conflict, and how long-term sustainable peacemaking strategies can address these seemingly chronic problems. This series of Conflict Zone is produced by PeaceRep, an international research project exploring the changing nature of conflict, peace, and transition process in the contemporary world. PeaceRep is funded by the UK Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. The information and views set out in this podcast are those of our experts, and nothing herein constitutes the views of the FCDO. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Mary Calder, Professor of Global Governance at the London School of Economics and Director of the LSE's PeaceRep program. Joining us virtually at the studio is Oksana Potapova, a Ukrainian peace-building research and activist pursuing a PhD at the Department of Gender Studies at the LSE. Mary, in your research, you have come across the most prominent violent conflicts in the post-Cold War era. But when we speak of Ukraine, you continuously attest to the remarkable level of civicness shown by ordinary Ukrainians. Although we have definitely reached a new peak in tensions between Russia and Ukraine, it is a culmination of events that stretch back to at least 2014 and the Revolution of Dignity in Ukraine. What is this story that takes us back by a decade?
So civicness is a phenomenon that we tend to observe in all conflict zones. And we call it civicness because it's not exactly the same as civil society. It's really about a logic of public authority. But along with that goes this kind of idea that there is such a thing as a state or municipality that does what's good for its people. And in return, people pay taxes and do their duties. And it's not just a logic, it's kind of a form of behavior, people acting as good citizens. And it may not be civil society groups, they're part of it, or they can be part of it. You can have rather uncivic civil society groups. But it is a political position as well as behavior. It's behavior by teachers, doctors, and others who do their job in an honest way, who don't take sectarian or corrupt ways of doing things, and that exists everywhere, otherwise societies would collapse. But it also is a political position. It's opposition to sectarianism and corruption, which I think was expressed in the Revolution of Dignity. I went to Ukraine soon after the Revolution of Dignity, and what impressed me was I don't think I've ever been in a country where I've seen so many civil society groups. And what people said to me was, look, we actually failed. We had the Revolution of Dignity, but we actually failed to get the sorts of people we wanted into government. We've still got oligarchs in power, but we decided we had to reform society ourselves. So that's what we're doing. So that was one thing, was this sense And of course, it was soon after the war had begun in the East when the army proved itself totally inadequate and people were volunteering for brigades and for other things and not just for civil society activities. So it felt like a do-it-yourself society, really. But the other thing that really struck me is that at that time I traveled throughout the South, where everyone is Russian-speaking. And what really impressed me was the way they felt so strongly Ukrainian. And they felt being Ukraine didn't, had nothing to do with ethnicity, and it had everything to do with politics. And that was the idea, really, that I think was born in the Revolution of Dignity. A political, not an ethnic, idea of Ukraine. So I think it's absolutely right that when Russia invaded, there was a popular resistance, and even now that continues. You know, people are providing aid, both military and humanitarian, to different battalions, to different people all over society. But actually, there was solidarity with the state, so there was a kind of united civic response in Ukraine, which makes Ukraine extremely different from the other conflicts we study in this program.
You mentioned the formation of volunteer battalions after the breakout of war in eastern Ukraine. Oksana, you yourself come from a city in the east and have worked closely with local NGOs on the ground. We know that Ukrainian women were volunteering early on to join battalions in the armed conflict as so-called invisible fighters. The name reflects the lack of official employment and structural opportunities for women to participate in the military, in the defense of their country. How has the situation evolved since, and what is the status of women in security and defense sectors today?
Speaking of women in the military, there has been a very big dynamic also since 2014. As Mary mentioned previously, there was a lot of self-organizing and volunteering happening in the first year of the war in Donbas, with a lot of volunteering happening, including among women. Some of them have been active in the Maidan protests and then went to the front line. Some have mobilized after the armed conflict started. And the challenge was that the roles of not only of these informal battalions, but more specifically of women in them, have not been recognized properly. It looked like women registering as secretaries or as cooks in the divisions when they were performing much more serious roles with much more risk and also potentially much more deserving much more compensation. This led to mobilization of civil society and a researchers community, and the project Invisible Battalion was initiated that included three iterations of research between 2015 and 2019 or 2020, if I'm not mistaken. The first research included just visibility of different roles that women have been playing in the armed forces, formal and informal. Then later on in their experiences inside the military, and the most recent one included deeper look into situations of sexual harassment inside the military structures. What this research and advocacy work has led to is the formal recognition of women's roles and the lifting of a ban for different professions that existed in Ukraine. It's a Soviet legacy that the list included around 400 different professions, some of them in the security and defense sector, but not only, that were apparently prohibited officially for women for supposedly health reasons. And, of course, it was a completely ridiculous ban that is no longer in place. It has also allowed women to get education in institutions that allow them to then take up jobs in the security and defense sector. And it has led to more promotion of women inside the structures, not nearly as much equality, of course, in higher ranking positions, but the potential is there. And while we see this as gains, of course, we cannot forget that military itself is a highly masculinized and hierarchical institution that is seen as a male dominated space. And challenges continue, and the change is very slow. For example, one of the, in my opinion, obvious changes that should have taken place is that women deserve to have a uniform made, tailor-made to female anatomy. And it hasn't happened to date, even after 1 year after full-scale invasion. So there are volunteer self-organized groups and projects that are now catering to that need within the military divisions inside Ukraine. And the second issue, of course, that continues to persist, the cases of sexual harassment, sexual violence, and lack of mechanisms and lack of culture of accountability for these inside the army. Another issue is the particularity of returnees, women who are veterans and who have had experience of combat, are then not properly sort of integrated into society. Services provided for veterans right now are still mostly tailored to men, or at least there isn't a gendered analysis of what difference of integration might mean. Also in terms of gender roles. I can say that I think it is important that on different levels, the symbolic recognition is there, and it's there inscribed in, for example, the president's narrative. Every time that he addresses the population, the society, he thanks the men and women defenders. And I think feminists have fought hard for this to be part of the discourse. Now we just want to make sure that the discourse is followed by structural changes.
And again, when we look at the wartime conditions through a gendered lens, it seems to me that on a general society level, there is more burden being placed each day on women as the primary caretakers when their husbands or brothers leave to fight. We can also observe the over 8 million Ukrainian refugees registered in Europe. They are predominantly women and children. What are the implications of all this?
I think it's a very important angle and to consider as we speak about war and the post-war, whenever that will be. And I would like to start with making maybe the obvious or not so obvious comment that the problem that we are discussing now, burden on women, is not something that became apparent only during war. In fact, I think it became much more apparent to the whole world also during the pandemic. And the unfortunate situation of Ukraine is that we just rolled into the full-scale war right after the pandemic. I think the reason why this is being talked about so much is also because the global community, feminist community, and policymakers have become much more apparent to this unproportionate care burden that has been placed on women globally, when the whole world sort of stopped working and returned back to working from home, and turned out that even when both partners are at home, women are still doing more of the work. Of course, in the case of Ukraine, this has been exacerbated not only by the fact that the economy itself is struggling, but because a lot of the infrastructure that is provided by the state and for caring not only for children, but also for the sick, the mental health, physical health, education is under attack. There is lack of physical security and also lack of capacity to absorb all of the needs that are emerging. And yes, the burden is disproportionately falling on women who are somehow becoming both carers for the displaced families, for the vulnerable relatives and family members, but also by the fact that they are becoming single-headed households, basically. So in many situations, women are the ones who are also working and taking care of families, which then adds to the mental health issues and the mental workload. And to me, this isn't only about women. It's about how we think about society as a whole. And this resilience that is being praised so much that you mentioned in the beginning, I think we need to be really honest with ourselves about what is the backbone of that resilience, who is doing most of the labor to maintain this resilience, and is this labor being recognized, be seen as a part of the recovery, and most importantly also are the needs and the voices of these groups that are now at the front of this supportive work taken into consideration.
And Oksana, I think you raise a very important question here about whose voices are truly being heard. It may seem on one side as if you are taking a rather forward-looking perspective, but conversations on the reconstruction of Ukraine remain high on the agendas of both the Ukrainian government and that of its allies. We have already seen pledges of over 40 countries, including stakeholders beyond Europe, like the US and Japan, to rebuild damaged infrastructure in the impacted regions. At this early stage, are you seeing any gaps in the inclusivity of the process?
A lot of the international partners, as you mentioned, can start thinking systemically, as they already are trying to do. Of course, the recovery needs to include infrastructure, and that assessment of the needs for infrastructure needs to be definitely inclusive of different groups. Women are usually voice children need, or what the elderly need in terms of the types of schools, types of playgrounds, and types of hospitals, because a woman does this job and she understands what is needed. The recovery also needs to take into account larger issues of holistic and comprehensive security and safety in communities, which includes access to services, health services, mental health services, and last but not least, of course, economy and socioeconomic opportunities, which might, if they are not in place, prevent many refugees from returning. And some recent polls, opportunities for employment have been one of the main reasons for people considering going back to Ukraine to actually coming back. And another big factor was, of course, access to infrastructure and services for children and family members that are now outside of Ukraine. I will mention two main aspects. One is labor rights. Unfortunately, Ukraine has seen over the last year a rollback on labor rights, with several acts of legislation being passed that have given more freedom to business owners and to employers, and less opportunities for the workers to defend their rights. This may lead, according to some analysis of labor rights activists, more specifically to marginalization of women, as it gives more freedom to employers to decide who they hire and on which terms. There may be increase in gender-based, age-based discrimination. Or, for example, you know, we've seen before questions to women like, do you have children? Are you planning to have children? And things like this, that may either come back or exacerbate. And secondly, women are predominantly the owners of small businesses, service-based businesses, community-based businesses. Now it's important to start to keep investing in support of these businesses, and to not allow a situation where sort of big companies and big corporations are coming over and taking over the major industries in maybe some of the less obvious areas, even like farming, for example. Women small farmers are a huge backbone of the economy and also the food security and resilience. One last thing I will say here is that right now, the trends that we are seeing around the Ukraine Recovery Conference to take place in London this summer are concerning, I would say, because the government of the UK, who is hosting the conference, has announced that their main purpose would be to facilitate business engagement in recovery. And they see civil society as an equal partner. The main role for civil society would be to just basically open the door and to make sure there is no corruption, or the corruption that is there can be called out, basically to ease the way for business instead of keeping business accountable. And I think this is where we come full circle to the idea of civicness and local ownership, where Ukraine is in a place where we cannot say no to international support, including international business, of course, coming in. But I think we need to make sure that the capacity to push back against violations of workers' rights, against unjust economic advances and investment policies, that capacity will be there inside Ukraine and inside Ukrainian civil society.
Well, indeed, that is very important. So what can you say about the actual capacity of Ukrainian authorities on a national and local level to provide such inclusivity themselves?
Also a very important question and can be addressed on several levels. I would say that here the efforts are also multifaceted. There is an effort on the international front by the host countries that are organizing recovery conferences like the one coming up in London. And there is something to be said about the role of these hosting governments. And of course, the leading role that the Ukrainian government is taking at the moment, unfortunately, I think it's perceived by those trying to be part of it as something in between chaotic and semi-closed, unfortunately. The most recent news about the Recovery and Reconstruction Agency that was established, now chaired by Mustafa Naim, have come out, and yet it's still not very clear what is the mechanism for proper engagement, if at all, with civil society. It seems to be more the agency that will be involved in procurement, in business and things like this. The role of civil society might be, in fact, more important on the local level, not only on the national. I think it is important to continue to carve out spaces to influence national level policies, but a lot of decisions are being made and hopefully will continue to be made on local level. And they also illustrate that recovery is very different depending on what region and even what size of the community we are talking about. So to me, the question of civil society participation comes right back at the heart of the question of the state of democracy and also local democracy in Ukraine, and whether the government is committed to, first of all, maintaining the structures of participation that have been there and also hopefully even democratizing them further. Unfortunately, over the last year, if we speak about participation of women, we have seen a rollback on women's participation in formal decision making. This is something that testified by women themselves in terms of being excluded from decisions about distribution of humanitarian assistance or decisions about how local housing or infrastructure is being distributed. For example, one of the things that has happened is the spaces that have been used as shelters for survivors of domestic violence have been sort of reappropriated and used for hosting the internally displaced communities, which is, of course, understandable, but maybe shouldn't be the case when one vulnerable group takes over the limited resources available for the other group. And this is, again, something to take into account when bigger programs come in, how much voices of local communities are taken into account. Because, of course, big donors and governments also have a tendency to overlook that and come in with big portfolios and large plans. I think here the Women, Peace and Security agenda can also be quite useful as a tool and as an accountability mechanism, which isn't directly linked to recovery as such, but it is a UN agenda, a set of resolutions that requires governments and also international and intergovernmental organizations to commit to gender analysis and gender inclusion, all stages of war and post-war recovery. And participation of women in decision-making is one of the main pillars of the Women, Peace and Security agenda. So something that I would recommend is to use the Women, Peace and Security agenda as an advocacy tool and to stress on it, making sure that women's voices are part of all the decisions that are being made at this stage.
Mary, you too have written extensively on the urgency of addressing the social needs of Ukrainians through, of course, domestic policy, but also as a signal to foreign donors and multilateral organizations providing assistance. It is no secret that financial assistance from abroad has served as a lifeline for the Ukrainian economy. But given such high dependency on aid, what is currently potentially overlooked or ill-considered by Western donors?
I think there are two issues that are really important on the part of external donors. One is that the lending shouldn't add to the debt. As much as possible, there should be grants and there should be an agreed debt cancellation program. But the other is that as much as possible should be produced inside Ukraine. Most of the lending comes with by French, by American, by German. And actually what you need to do is to encourage domestic production so people are earning wages. And wars are usually old-fashioned wars at times when you got increased autarky. Everything was produced domestically, food, everything. And actually the Ukraine, it is now producing more grain. It is now producing more electricity. So it's back to exporting grain and electricity. But it should be producing many more of its own needs. And the external community really needs to emphasize that, as well as the idea that they're providing gifts. So typically, new wars are completely globalized wars. They're wars in which production falls dramatically and everybody's totally dependent on the external world, which is why there are all kinds of international links, transnational smuggling networks, all these kinds of things as a way of generating foreign exchange, because generating foreign exchange becomes so important. And I think in Ukraine, it's really important to generate more domestic revenue, both through progressive taxation and through increased domestic production.
When we speak about old and new wars, it is actually a term that you coined in a book authored by you in 2007 called New and Old Wars, which talks about the evolution of warfare in the post-Cold War era. You say that Russia's war today in Ukraine resembles the older and more conventional style of conflict. If we look at what's happening on the battlefield at the very moment, we see battles of attrition, high casualty rates on both sides, and somewhat of a stalemate with neither parties making significant pushes. What is Putin's logic of thinking here? Is his goal, may it be, to turn the war into a protracted and long-running affair?
Interesting thing about the new wars, whether you're talking about the Second Chechen War, which was the first war he got involved in when he came to power, the war in Georgia, the war in Syria, and then in the Donbass, it seems as though his aim was not necessarily to control these areas, but to prevent, thwart democracy, to try to create a long-term situation of intractable violence, which is really what I mean by new wars. And that he succeeded in doing in all these places. You know, Chechnya is bandit kingdom, completely dependent on Russian finance. He set up these statelets, Abkhazia and Ossetia in Georgia, which really weakened Georgian democracy. And Syria is just a terrible situation, not only divided by areas controlled by Assad, Turkey, the Kurds, but also even within the Assad-controlled bit, there are basically militias established all over the country. And I think this really was his, at least it was definitely his aim in 2014. In 2013, Gerasimov, who's now in charge of the forces in southern Ukraine, published this article that everybody in the West picked up on called Nonlinear War, which really talked about this type of war. And said how easy it was to turn a country into chaos through a combination of special forces, local dissidents, and what they call political technology, i.e. disinformation. And essentially that is what they did in 2014. And what made this war different was that it started with a conventional invasion. It didn't start on this kind of model of nonlinear war. And I think that was probably Putin's hubris. You know, he'd been alone through the COVID years. He'd been a bubble. He kind of was beginning to believe in all these stories of Peter the Great and the idea that the Ukrainians were really Russians and would welcome him. And he thought somehow he could invade Ukraine the way America invaded Iraq and Afghanistan.
Without any consequences.
Without any consequences. And he discovered he was wrong. And now he's back to the old aim, which is, you know, he will have won if he can just keep the war going. He doesn't have to control more territory. He just has to keep the war going. which is terribly depressing. And so the question really on the Ukrainian side is really, can he succeed in reducing the Ukrainian state to the same situation as we see in Chechnya or Syria or wherever? I think it's perfectly possible if this stalemate continues for a long time, and it's perfectly possible in two respects. Part of creating intractable violence is fomenting ethnic conflict, and already you're seeing in Ukraine, quite understandably, a huge hatred of Russia. And there's this sort of new emphasis on the Ukrainian language and not speaking Russian. And so there is a kind of risk that that could turn into ethnic conflict. And the other risk that I think is really, really important is that, as I was just saying before, how long can civil society, can civic energy be sustained in the face of a war? Can people go on voluntarily providing humanitarian assistance, military assistance, schools, hospitals? You know, doesn't there need to be much greater state investment in all of that? And that is, to me, a big worry that, you know, the formal economy has fallen, industrial production has fallen, unemployment has risen, wages have fallen, everybody's got weapons. At what point do people turn to looting as a form of survival? I think it's already begun in some parts of eastern Donbass. And so the question, the really big question is, can this civic Ukrainian spirit be sustained? And if it can't, Putin would have won.
For now, that concludes today's episode on Ukraine and its civic resistance against Russian military aggression. We hope you found it informative and educational, and you can find out more information on the Conflict and Civicness Research Group page of the LSE website. There you can also find details on upcoming events, videos of previous ones, and links to all our publications. Please do follow us on Twitter at LSE_CCRG, and we hope to see you next time.